Yesterday, we got some good news.
We're now on track to have enough vaccine supply for every adult in America by the end of May.
President Biden announcing a faster pace to potential nationwide vaccination and also a move that may help increase the supply of the vaccines. Merck will aid Johnson & Johnson in production of their vaccine, which was approved last week by the FDA. This collaboration is definitely not normal for the longtime competitors. It's worth repeating. Biden says enough doses for every adult in the country should be available
by the end of May.
But that said, we're not out of the woods yet by a long shot, with long waiting lists and confusion happening around the country for those still waiting to be vaccinated. And in a state like Texas, which is averaging more than 7,000 new COVID cases per day, Governor Greg Abbott made a big announcement of his own yesterday.
All businesses of any type are allowed to open 100%. Also, I am ending the statewide mask mandate.
So, with the expanding vaccination efforts around the country, what can or should we actually do? How do we avoid slipping back into the danger zone? And even beyond that, what does it mean once you are vaccinated? What habits can return from the before times? And what doesn't come back? You have questions. We're going to try to get you some answers. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host and producer of NPR and WNYC's Consider This, in for Tanzina Vega. Breaking down all of your vaccine questions is where we start today on The Takeaway. To help us out, we have Apoorva Mondavilli, science reporter at The New York Times. Welcome back, Apoorva.
So happy to be back, as always.
Also with us is Jennifer Nuzzo, lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. Jennifer, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the Biden administration's announcement that the country was on track to have enough vaccines for every adult by the end of May. Apoorva, your reaction?
I think it's not at all unreasonable to think that we would have enough by May. I don't actually think supply is going to be an issue. Even maybe in April, I think actually the bigger issue is going to be to get all of the people who are hesitant to get the vaccine.
And Jennifer?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I'm worried about that. I'm also just worried about how quickly states are able to give it out. I think using the pharmacies, as the Biden administration has announced they plan to do, will be helpful. But there still is going to need to be state-provided vaccines. And we know that states have been really kind of all over the board in terms of how quickly they're able to administer.
And before we get to listener questions, the news from Texas. Jennifer, what are your thoughts on the state lifting its mask mandate?
I just can't comprehend it, frankly. I mean, I understand the pressure that governors are under to open businesses, particularly in the face of falling case numbers. But masks are the pathway to keeping businesses and schools open. Now is not the time for this. We still have dangerously high case numbers. It's great news that they're falling, but they're still dangerously high. And I really worry that it's going to set us back.
Apoorva?
And actually, I don't even think in Texas they are falling. They're sort of staying high. They've fallen by about 10%, but that's, you know, that could go either way. And as Jennifer said, masks will be the way that we can actually keep things open. So when I heard the news, I had the stone drop in my stomach. I just wrote a story about how we may have a fourth wave, and this is exactly what's going to get us to a fourth wave.
Okay, let's pivot. We asked all of you out there to send us your questions about the vaccine and what you can start to do and think about after you get the shots, and we want to get to them. So I think these first two are probably top of mind for a lot of people out there. I know they are for me. Take a listen.
I'd like to understand when and how it will be possible for me and my son and my husband to go visit and hug and sit close to my parents, who are both in their late 70s. We'll be vaccinated not until sometime, well into the summer, but they will have had both of their shots for a long time at that point. And we just want to understand when we can be close, because we really miss them.
Hi, my question is about my parents. They're 81 years old. They live in Montreal, Canada, and they are scheduled to be vaccinated by April. They're really anxious to get to Los Angeles to visit with myself and my 14-year-old daughter. My daughter is the more pressing attraction, of course. But my concern is it safe, first of all, for them to travel once they've had the two shots? And is it advisable for them to stay with us since neither my daughter nor myself will be vaccinated by that time?
Apoorva, what are your thoughts on these questions?
I think as long as they've waited long enough after those two shots for the immunity to fully take effect, it should be okay for them to travel, but still with masks, with distancing, with hand washing. I would not recommend not having masks on just because you're vaccinated. But I think given all those precautions, especially if other people in the family are vaccinated, but maybe even if they're not, they will be okay.
Jennifer, not surprisingly, we have more questions on family. This one, however, is about newbies.
My name is Talia Berman-Hand. I'm in University Place, Washington. And my question is, can my family members who've been vaccinated visit my newborn? Is there a wait time? Could they be carriers of anything? Is there anything we need to do to be extra safe? Additionally, my husband and I are not vaccinated yet. So is that another variable?
Jennifer, what are your thoughts on this situation?
Yeah, that's a much harder situation to weigh in on, in part because we don't have great data to guide us here. There are two things that make me worry about that scenario, and I very much agree with what Apoorva said about the previous question in terms of vaccinated grandparents and the safety of their traveling and being with other family members. But in this question, I'm worried about the young infant, because while we know that children have been less frequently represented among cases, there is a risk in particular for children under 12 months. So since we think the vaccines are likely to reduce transmission, but we don't know how much and we don't know if it's complete, I would be perhaps worried about vaccinated people holding and having very close contact with an infant.
Let's play another call from Maeve in Brooklyn, New York.
My question is it safe for our parents to get together with their friends who are all vaccinated inside without masks after the 2-week waiting window after their second shots? Thank you.
I think small groups of vaccinated people getting together shouldn't be too much of a risk, especially if they don't sit way too close to each other. We know that the risk of transmission from somebody who's vaccinated is not zero, but it's likely to be fairly small. And then when you multiply that for two people for whom the risk is pretty small, it really goes down. So that, I think, sounds okay to me.
I agree with that. I mean, I think we also have to distinguish where these events occur. And if they occur in private, that's great. But one of the challenges, I think, is when people go out in public. And I mean, there's two components to what we're concerned about. One is about keeping the norms of social distancing until we get more people vaccinated. And the other one is the unknown risk to people who haven't yet been vaccinated.
Jennifer, when can we hug our friends again? This question was sent by one of our listeners, and I think a lot of us can relate to how hard it's been to just miss that human contact.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, first of all, if the friends are vaccinated, I do not feel that it's that great of a risk to hug your friends if you're both vaccinated. The Centers for Disease Control are going to be issuing new guidance very soon about what vaccinated people can do. And if they say otherwise, I would be inclined to follow it because I think it's important to have a national science body make recommendations and for us to adhere to them based on the evidence that's available. But I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Apoorva, let's talk outdoor events. We got a couple questions about this. Here they are.
This is Carrie from Oregon, and I just learned the fall football schedule. And what I'm wondering is if I can go and watch my Oregon Ducks put the herd on the Washington Huskies on November 6th and scream my lungs out. Maybe if everybody has a vaccine certificate, we could do that.
Hi, this is Tom McCarter from Vista, California, and I want to know, when are we going to start having live concerts again?
Any good news for Carrie or Tom? And are there differences between those two kinds of events, Apoorva?
Yeah, the outdoor one is my favorite kind of question, because then I get to give good news and say, yeah, I think that'll be totally okay by then. To be, you know, in November, I think all of the adults who might be there will probably be vaccinated. And if, especially if they can show that they're vaccinated, the risk outdoors we already know is very small. Concerts is a different issue. I mean, if it's an outdoor concert, sure, go ahead. But indoor concert is so much is going to, again, depend on ventilation and whether everybody who will gather indoors is vaccinated.
Jennifer, quite a few of our listeners sent in questions asking about transmission. Can you clear up that confusion? What do we know about whether or not vaccinated individuals still spread the virus?
So we, I think, have good reason to hope that the vaccines will reduce transmission. We don't know fully how much, and we don't know for all vaccines. We do have some promising data from some of the vaccines, and I think based on what we know about how vaccines work, we would expect to see transmission be reduced by the vaccines. But it may not be, and in my view, probably likely isn't going to be a completely perfect reduction in transmission. I think we will still see some level of transmission. But, you know, we're using the vaccines largely to kind of defang the virus and to reduce, and the trials have shown that it does this quite nicely, severe illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. So in my view, having a vaccine or vaccines that do that, you know, really begin to change our relationship to the virus. And so even to the earlier question about, like, when can these things resume? I mean, I think if we are at a point where any adult who wants to be vaccinated is, and we have participation in the offering of vaccinations, I think the fall could look very different than what it is now. And we might be doing some of those things that we right now are hesitant to do.
And do we know anything about asymptomatic transmission for those that are vaccinated?
So this goes into it. I mean, one of the trials did look at the presence of infection regardless of symptoms, and there was a good signal there. And we have some reason to think that transmission would be different. But again, we don't have it teased out for all the vaccines. We don't have a sense of how much of a reduction for all the vaccines, and we don't have it teased out according to symptoms.
I just want to jump in there and talk about something that I've been obsessing over lately, which is variants. The one variant, B.1.1.7, that was identified in the UK, that seems to respond just as well to vaccines as what we've been seeing in the United States. But there are a few new ones, including the one in New York, that have a mutation that some people are worried about. It's called E484K, or EEK, as they're nicknaming it. But it's the one in South Africa and the one in Brazil, and both of those have now proven to be a little bit less easy to defeat for a vaccine. So I would watch that space very carefully.
And Apurva, one listener in California wants to know, what do we do if enough people decline to receive the COVID-19 vaccine and herd immunity isn't reached? What happens?
That's a tough one. You know, vaccination mandates never work, and I'm sure Jennifer knows more about this than I do, but hopefully people will come around as they see that everyone around them is vaccinated and they haven't grown horns or anything, and that it's safe. But if, you know, the really diehard, hesitant people, maybe they will be pressured by businesses or by their kids' schools, or I'm not really sure what's going to happen there.
Yeah, I think we have to maybe start rethinking a little bit what we're doing with the vaccine, which is that if we are able to use the vaccine, as the vaccines promise we can do, to take off the table the possibility of being hospitalized or dying from the virus, I really do think that that's going to change how we think about the virus. In my view, I mean, first of all, the concept of herd immunity is a really complicated one, and it's going to vary by location. It's going to vary by the social habits of the people who get vaccinated. And it is not one single end state. It's a bit more dynamic than I think it's often talked about. You know, I do think that we could be at the point where there is some level of circulation that we are able to live with because we have taken off the table the fact, you know, the possibility of people winding up in the hospital. I mean, we live with other coronaviruses. What sets this one apart is the level of, you know, the severity of illness that it causes. And so this is why I think it's we're so incredibly fortunate to have the vaccines that we do, because that is our pathway to freedom from worry that we could become quite ill from becoming infected.
But again, I think we have to worry about the variants. If B.1.1.7 really takes off here, I think that could still drive up the numbers for the people who are unvaccinated, obviously not the ones who are.
it's just hard for me to imagine that we're going to get to a point where we stop the virus from circulating. I think we'll have lower numbers. And I do think the other fortunate news about the vaccines that we have is that there is the possibility to change if we do find that there's a variant that is not responsive. I mean, I do think even with the news we've had to date, the vaccines are still offer a good promise of protection against the variants we've seen so far. Less for sure, but in some cases, but still promising. So I do think that, you know, it'll be nice for people not to have to worry about being winding up in the hospital if they get it.
Mm. I have another question for both of you. One of our listeners in Syracuse, New York asks, my friend is having a wedding in July of 100 people. I will be fully vaccinated and much of the wedding will be outside. Should I go? Apoorva, you first.
Again, if it's an outdoor wedding and this person is vaccinated, it sounds okay, but some of it also depends on how many other people there are not vaccinated. If let's assume that most of the people there are vaccinated, have fun.
Jennifer?
Looking ahead, I expect that July we will be in a better place, but I think Apoorva is right to bring up the variants and the possibility of change. And so I think if you are accepting of the fact that the situation could change quite considerably before and now and then, that's an important, I think, a degree of flexibility to have. But I think right now the idea of vaccinated people attending an outdoor wedding is a reasonable prospect.
And we got this call about flying as well.
Hi, this is Catherine in Brooklyn. I'm wondering if you all think it'll be safe for folks to travel internationally come summer, like August.
Jennifer, start with you.
Yeah, I mean, this is a more challenging situation because the U.S. is really leading in terms of its rollout of vaccine. And so, you know, if somebody is vaccinated, of course, I'm less worried about their traveling, whether people will be able to travel, whether there will be restrictions or shutdowns in countries that have not been quite as fast to roll out vaccines is another story. So I think, again, if you're vaccinated, the risk to you is probably limited. But there is, of course, the possibility that the situation in countries will get worse, particularly with the spread of variants and the slow vaccine rollout.
Mm. I mean, if all the people traveling are adults, great. And they're all vaccinated. But if they have kids, it's unlikely they're going to be vaccinated, all of them, you know, by the end of the year, maybe in the fall sometime. But before they are, you know, kids may not get very sick themselves, but they may pick up something, a different variant that's circulating in a different country and bring it home.
We have one question from listener Jose Hernandez, and he asks, are we going to see official vaccine passports in the near future to make travel safer? Apoorva.
Sounds like we are. I mean, there are a lot of ethical issues with those, but I'm hearing more and more talk about that. And some countries have already started to do it. So wouldn't be surprising. And it's not unprecedented. You know, there are other diseases for which yellow fever, for example, for which people have had to show that they're vaccinated in order to come into a country or to go do certain activities.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possibly inevitable. I do deeply worry about this. I mean, the equity problems are enormous. I mean, right now, the countries that are vaccinating are largely high-income countries, and the willingness of these countries to share their vaccine has been quite limited. So we are essentially leaving holes of the planet unprotected and then further penalizing them by restricting their ability to travel, which has economic ramifications. The other thing that I do worry about is that, yes, we have vaccine cards for yellow fever, but we also know that these are forged. So just because we have a passport doesn't mean it's safe. And, you know, I think if we have this system where there's scarcity of vaccines and penalties for not being vaccinated, we should expect to see compliance and verification issues.
And we have a final question from Carmen.
Hi, this is Carmen in Potomac, Virginia. One question I have about the COVID-19 vaccine, which I am very excited to take, is can I drink the same half a bottle of wine a night that I do every other night after I get the vaccine, either the first dose or the second dose? Very important question I need to know the answer to, and I think a lot of other people do. Thank you so much.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I get it. The pandemic has been tough. There is no guidance to suggest you shouldn't, that you need to scale back on the wine because of the vaccine. I mean, I think there are probably other health considerations there, but the vaccine itself should not be the reason why you're scaling. It doesn't have to be the reason why you're scaling back.
Any thoughts, Apoorva?
I mean, I agree with that. You know, more power to her if she can actually get through a half bottle of wine and every day or every other day and still get her work done or whatever she's doing.
Apurva Mandavilli is a science reporter at the New York Times, and Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Recently, the Biden administration released an intelligence report that found that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the operation that resulted in the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And while the Biden administration announced financial and travel restrictions on those involved in Khashoggi's death, the sanctions do not extend to Mohammed bin Salman. Here with us to discuss the Biden administration's approach to foreign policy and the status of the U.S.-Saudi relationship is Nehal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter at Politico. Nehal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nehal, talk to me about President Biden's approach to foreign policy so far. Where do you see the starkest differences between the former President Trump's approach to foreign policy and President Biden's approach?
I'd say it's two stark differences. One is a matter of tone. Biden just is a bit calmer, doesn't use Twitter, doesn't throw things out there that are wild and unpredictable. And so I think a lot of people around the world appreciate that. And the second big difference I would say is that Biden is more inclined to talk to U.S. allies and partners in a good way versus President Trump, who often belittled U.S. allies and partners and preferred a more unilateral approach to foreign policy.
Last week, the Biden administration released a report on the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, a critic of the Saudi government and a journalist who wrote for The Washington Post. What does the report tell us that wasn't already publicly known?
A lot of the report was publicly known. I think this was more a matter of just getting it out there, making the move to, you know, fulfill the law and getting it public. But the basic thing is that the intelligence community determined that because of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's, kind of de facto control over the country, his extensive control, that he was the one who must have ordered the operation that led to the death of Jamal Khashoggi. And so they put the responsibility on him. And this is, you know, it's the clearest indication, the most visible one, of the U.S. putting the blame on Mohammed bin Salman. The Trump administration did not want to release this report, largely because they didn't want to affect the relationship with Saudi Arabia.
In 2019, during a debate, Biden was asked if he would punish senior Saudi leaders for Khashoggi's death. And this is what he said.
Khashoggi was, in fact, murdered and dismembered. And I believe in the order of the Crown Prince. And I would make it very clear, we were not going to, in fact, sell more weapons to them. We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. There's very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia.
How is that rhetoric different from what we're hearing from the White House today?
Well, when it comes to the Crown Prince himself, the White House has not put any sanctions on him or taken any moves that directly target the Crown Prince. But the Biden administration will argue that they are punishing Saudi Arabia as a whole and that the Crown Prince is being named and shamed to a certain degree. I mean, they are, you know, reducing our cooperation with the Saudis in places like Yemen. They have put dozens of Saudis on visa restrictions lists as a result of this. But the critics will say, look, it's not enough to go for underlings and make moves that down the line can easily be reversed. You have to go after bin Salman himself to set a standard and to make the point. The Crown Prince is in his mid-30s. He could rule the kingdom for decades when his father dies. So people really want to send a message to him now.
Members of Congress say they're concerned over the lack of accountability for members of the Saudi government. Is there space for Congress to take action if they find Biden's approach to be inadequate?
Sure. I mean, we're already seeing some legislation introduced to try to ban Mohammed bin Salman from coming to the United States and take other moves against him. And there is a lot of antipathy toward the Crown Prince and the Saudi government on the Hill right now, and it crosses both parties. So there is space for some legislation to perhaps possibly make it to Biden's desk. Now, there's no guarantee of that, and he could veto it. And if he does, there might not be enough support to override that veto. At the end of the day, though, you know, with so many different foreign crises, it's questionable how quickly people in Congress are going to want to take this up.
Nihal, has Mohammed bin Salman or other members of the Saudi government attempted to address this tension?
I have not seen anything from the Crown Prince himself. The Saudi government has rejected the report that was released the other day. They have claimed that this was a rogue operation, and there's no indication that the Crown Prince himself is going to take responsibility. I doubt that will ever happen, certainly not anytime soon.
Last month, President Biden did announce that the U.S. would stop providing offensive support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. But what do we know about how the Biden administration is thinking about arms sales to the kingdom more generally?
You know, I think you're going to see stricter scrutiny. They are reviewing some of these arms sales. And I think there is definitely going to be some efforts to reduce the possibility that the U.S. would sell offensive weapons to the Saudis. But, you know, the possibility that they might sell defensive weapons, you know, like anti-missile batteries or whatever, that exists. The problem is that a lot of arms experts will tell you that, you know, there are a lot of weapons where you're not really sure whether they're offensive or defensive. So it could come down to definitions.
And then just this week, the Biden administration announced sanctions on senior members of the Russian government related to the poisoning and jailing of Alexei Navalny, leader of the opposition. So why is it that President Biden is willing to penalize senior members of the Russian government over Saudi Arabian officials?
Well, Russia is a U.S. adversary and Saudi Arabia is a U.S. partner. And that's kind of what it comes down to. You know, we know the Russians are going to work against us on virtually every level, not every level, but a lot of levels. In theory, the Saudis are supposed to be our partners and they're helping us in things like fighting terrorism, Al-Qaeda, and, you know, and there are efforts to kind of lower tensions between Arab states and Israel that the Saudi Arabia is a key part of as well. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. It's easier to beat up on somebody who's your avowed adversary than your partner.
And tell us more about Iran.
Well, you know, the rise of Iran and its activities in the Middle East are of great concern to the United States and Israel, as well as America's Arab allies. And so, you know, even the Biden administration views Iran as a major threat, just as the Trump administration did. And they want to cooperate with the Saudis and others in trying to contain Iran, not simply for its nuclear program, but also for, you know, its use of proxy forces, its ballistic missile program. It's all sorts of things that the U.S. sees Iran as being culpable for.
Lastly, Nihal, what will you be looking out for when it comes to President Biden's approach to diplomacy?
I'm actually really interested in seeing how much of what he does actually changes behavior on the world stage. So far, they're making statements, they're issuing sanctions, they're doing all sorts of things, but I haven't seen a lot of behavior change. And, you know, someone was telling me, well, that might be too high a bar. And I was just like, well, then what's the point if we can't change behavior on the world stage? So that's one of those things that I'm going to keep a close eye on. And I think Mohammed bin Salman is actually one of the examples I want to see. Are these actions against the Saudi government, if not him himself, going to actually change his behavior? I think that's, you know, remains to be seen.
We have to leave it there. Nihal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nihal Tusi is a foreign affairs reporter at Politico.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega. You're listening to The Takeaway. Last week, abortion was front and center at the confirmation hearing for Javier Becerra, President Biden's nominee for Health and Human Services Secretary, with many Republicans attacking his record on the issue.
For many of us, your record has been as very extreme on abortion issues. Other pro-life groups, have put a lot of information out there that basically you've been against pro-life on the record.
If confirmed, Becerra and the Biden administration will have a lot on their plates, reversing course on 4 years of anti-abortion policies from the Trump administration. At the same time, abortion cases remain under threat on the local level as states including South Carolina, New Hampshire, and Arizona continue to put in place restrictive laws, from so-called heartbeat bills to ones criminalizing abortion providers. Here to walk us through the latest on abortion rights at both the federal and state level is Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University and the author of several books about abortion, including Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot to get through, but let's start with Javier Becerra's confirmation hearings. Why did abortion politics become such a key part of last week's hearings?
Well, I think abortion opponents have always seen Becerra as not just someone who supports a right to choose, but someone who has been actively exposing some elements of the anti-abortion movement. So, for example, as Attorney General of California, Becerra was part of an effort to force crisis pregnancy centers to post notifications about the availability of abortion services or the fact that they weren't medical clinics. He was involved in an effort to prosecute some of the folks who had put out videos claiming that Planned Parenthood was selling fetal body parts for money. So I think part of it was an effort to fit into a kind of existing narrative that religious conservatives, Christian conservatives in particular, are no longer welcome in the public square, and painting Becerra as an extremist fit that narrative, I think.
Mary, remind us, what did the Trump administration mean for abortion rights at the federal level? What kind of policies were put in place restricting access?
Well, some of the policies will be easier to unwind. The Trump administration put in place a gag rule requiring anyone receiving federal family planning funding from refraining from making referrals on abortion, even when patients request them. The administration really beefed up so-called conscience protections and made available to people with religious objections to abortion a much broader array of protections, even when they're not really directly involved in abortion. So, imagine the secretary answering the phone at a medical clinic. The administration interfered with funding for family planning and abortion abroad. And then, of course, probably the most lasting impact and the one that the Biden administration will struggle the most to undo was Trump's impact on the courts. Trump nominated an almost historically high number of federal judges to the bench and three justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, which will mean both that if Biden enacts affirmative policies, he'll have to get those policies through an increasingly conservative federal judiciary. And it'll also mean that Biden will have to play catch up if he's trying to shape the courts himself.
Yeah. So in January, the Supreme Court banned access to abortion pills by mail during the pandemic. What does that signal?
Well, I think probably the most surprising thing about that was that the Supreme Court chose to act at all. So the FDA has long had a requirement that patients taking medication abortion, which is a two-pill protocol, have to get one of those pills in person from a doctor. There's long been studies showing that the in-person requirement doesn't really add any value medically for patients, especially because they're still allowed to take that pill at home. But The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and other plaintiffs argued that this requirement was unconstitutional during the pandemic because it exposed patients to a greater risk of COVID, and the lower court agreed. The U.S. Supreme Court could have easily just sat on its hands, as it had been doing for months, if it didn't want to get involved in the abortion battle. And yet it chose to decide the case, even knowing that in all likelihood the Biden administration is going to do something either to suspend or permanently eliminate that requirement. So it does suggest that the court is not afraid to get its hands dirty when it comes to abortion, and that we may expect bolder moves from the court in the near future.
We're still very early on in the Biden-Harris administration, but have we seen any major policy changes related to abortion so far?
Well, we've seen some smaller ones that we would expect of any Democratic administration. The Biden-Harris administration has rolled back the so-called Mexico City policy, which has reinstated support for international family planning funding, including for abortion. And the administration is taking steps to change most of the Trump administration's regulations, although trying to do so in a thoughtful way so they don't open themselves up to court challenge. We haven't yet seen the administration make abortion a priority, though, when it comes to more controversial moves like repealing the so-called Hyde Amendment, which deals with Medicaid funding for abortion, or fulfilling one of President Biden's campaign promises, which was to, quote-unquote, make Roe v. Wade the law of the land.
So while all this is happening at the federal level, we're still seeing laws restricting abortion access at the state level. Mary, what kind of anti-abortion laws have been passed in recent weeks? And are there certain trends or patterns that you're noticing?
Well, I think there are a couple of patterns that are worth noting. The first is that some of the laws that we saw in 2019 that many sort of deemed to be too extreme for lots of states, including these heartbeat laws that ban abortion usually between the 6th and 8th week of pregnancy when a heartbeat or fetal cardiac activity can be detected. Those are sort of becoming normalized and are getting a hard look in states that are certainly red states, but not as homogeneously conservative, for example, as Alabama. So states like South Carolina or Texas. So I think in part what we're seeing is a response to Amy Coney Barrett's being on the court and an assumption that with six conservatives on the court, there must be a majority to reverse Roe. We're seeing a lot of focus on medication abortion, which makes sense given both that it's more common during the pandemic and also that it's been trending upward in terms of the number of total abortions performed even pre-pandemic. And I think we're also seeing a trend toward more technology-infused abortion restrictions, laws requiring things like hotlines or search engine tracking of people looking for abortion services. And finally, a more sort of information gathering or spying, right? Forcing either clinics or patients to disclose more information about themselves. And I think that's part of a longer-term push by states to make the case that people having abortions are not having abortions for reasons most people in the public would support.
And lastly, what kind of legal battles between the federal government and states should we expect to see in the coming year?
Well, all of the laws I detailed, particularly some things like the heartbeat laws, will be tied up in court. So there'll be ongoing tit-for-tat battles in the courts about whether these laws are unconstitutional. And usually the answer will be yes, unless or until the Supreme Court overturns Roe. If the Biden administration does choose to, for example, pass a federal law on abortion, we would expect to see conservative states challenge that as a violation of states' rights, kind of a replay of what we saw with Obamacare. And so there's kind of going to be an interesting interplay between what the states are going to do to try to push the Supreme Court to act and what the Biden administration can do to counter that without triggering Supreme Court challenges of its own. And that, of course, will probably revive calls to reform the courts on the left, because if the federal courts will ultimately break any kind of tie in the conflicts between the states and the federal government, the Biden administration will have to think about whether it's worth expending political capital to change the courts.
Mary Ziegler is a law professor at Florida State University and the author of several books about abortion, including Abortion and the Law in America. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Just can't wait to get in our beds again. The life we love is in the desert with our friends. And we can't wait to get in our vans again.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina. This past weekend, the movie Nomadland won the Golden Globes for Best Drama and Best Director, cementing its status as an Oscars frontrunner. The film, which is currently streaming on Hulu, was directed by Chloe Zhao and stars Frances McDormand as a woman named Fern who lives out of her van and from paycheck to paycheck. Other than McDormand, many of the people featured in the film are playing versions of themselves and actually live lifestyles similar to Fern's. Here's McDormand in a scene from the film speaking with an employment agent.
So when do you need to get back to work?
Now?
It is a tough time right now. You may want to consider registering for early retirement.
I don't think I can get by on the benefits. And, I need work. I like work.
I'm not sure exactly what you would be eligible for.
The film has picked up a considerable amount of praise, but it's also been met by a degree of backlash since its release, especially for its scenes filmed inside an actual Amazon warehouse. Some of its critics argue that the film goes too easy on the harsh reality of labor practices at Amazon.
Going places we may never go again, and we can't wait to get in our vans again.
With me now to discuss is Allison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Allison, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So you first saw Nomadland in the fall. What was your initial impression of the movie?
Well, Chloe Zhao is someone whose career I've been following, you know, over the course of the decade or so that she's been at it. And she's someone who I've always thought is a really interesting filmmaker who does a lot of work with people who are not professional actors. And you know, I think it's a really moving film. I think it really kind of captures, I think, this kind of complicated intersection between this idea of the old American West and this, like, independent streak in some of these characters, and then also this real kind of failure in terms of the safety net and what it's left these characters having to do.
For people who haven't seen the film, how would you describe the character of Fern?
Well, Fern is one of the few fictional characters, like fully fictional characters in the film. And she is a widow who lived in a company town that just basically evaporated after the mine that was there was closed down. So she has lost both, you know, her husband and her community in a short time and spends the film kind of learning about this community of people on the road who are simultaneously supporting each other, but also all kind of living independent lives, you know, in their vans and vehicles and kind of going to different places for seasonal work.
And she actually does spend so much time listening, right?
Yeah, she is kind of a tour guide in a way to this real world. And she spends a lot of time speaking to people who, you know, are really part of this lifestyle and who have come to it for different reasons, you know, whether it's economic necessity and desperation or whether it's a desire to kind of strip down and get away from kind of, you know, the work week. And I think it really, it's through her that we get a look at this kind of spectrum of experiences, you know, within the nomad community.
So we mentioned that parts of Nomadland were filmed inside an Amazon warehouse. And last week, Wilfred Chan wrote for Vulture, actually, that the film actually downplays the real stakes of this kind of labor. Where do you think the criticism of those scenes is coming from?
Well, I think that whenever you're going to see Amazon on screen, and particularly inside an Amazon warehouse, you know, which is not something that oftentimes cameras are invited into unless it's like through a very kind of controlled public relations experience. You know, Amazon has notorious and increasingly notorious kind of labor issues. And I think to see an Amazon warehouse on screen and not have it framed, you know, very explicitly as a critique of Amazon, which I don't think Nomadland, you know, does necessarily. I think that for a lot of people that who have critiqued the film for that, that is a failure, that it does not, you know, make more explicit the issues with Amazon and like what Amazon is essentially taking advantage of in its gig economy workers.
You recently interviewed the film's director, Chloe Zhao, and what was her response to the criticism of the Amazon scenes?
You know, Chloe's viewpoint was very interesting to me, which is that for her, Amazon is just one of the components kind of essentially taking advantage of this greater structural failure. You know, she said that this is a film about the kind of grander issues of like elder care and also about the lack of kind of, you know, economic stability and support for a lot of these characters who, you know, as the real people are in their 60s and sometimes 70s at an age when you would, you know, usually or at least used to be able to think about retiring and are instead, you know, working still and doing like oftentimes very taxing physical labor in order to kind of support themselves. So for Chloe, and I think that this is a valid point, she sees Amazon as like one of the components of that, but also, you know, doesn't want to, she wanted to point out that like when they have to shovel beets in Nebraska in November, that is also grueling work, you know, and that the cleaning toilets on a campground is also, like these are all part of what she sees as a larger structural critique.
And she actually told you that the film's politics might be obscured by the fact that it also features these really beautiful images of the Western United States. What do you think about that?
I think that there is an eternal struggle for us, and I think it is unresolvable and entirely personal, as to whether you need the aesthetics of a film to kind of mirror the message or in some cases the kind of misery that the characters are experiencing. And I think that they can coexist, you know, that you can have someone working in an Amazon warehouse and going outside to see the beautiful sunset outside, as, you know, she kind of put it. I don't think that romanticizes the larger issues at work, but I also understand why some people see it as an aesthetic that kind of maybe glosses over the themes. I just think that, you know, I think they're capable of coexisting, and you can be in an extraordinarily beautiful place and also be living a really difficult life.
And lastly, in the 30 seconds we have left, do you think the film manages to use the non-professional actors without exploiting them in a way?
Yeah, I think it feels very collaborative. And, you know, I spoke to some of them, including Bob Wells, who is the kind of spokesperson of the Nomad movement on YouTube. And he, you know, he shares this incredibly personal story in the film. And he said that for him, it felt like it was a healing moment to be able to share his pain, but also, as he put it, to kind of gift it to the movie and to the world.
Ah. Allison, Hillbilly Elegy is another movie from the past year that depicts people living in poverty. How would you compare the film's portrayal of its characters to Nomadlands?
You know, it's interesting. Nomadland and Hillbilly Elegy are essentially both portrayals of white American poverty. You know, I think Hillbilly Elegy was explicitly sold as that, and also as, in some ways, you know, in terms of the J.D. Vance book, the explanation for, you know, Trump, that, you know, and the kind of like surge of the particular, what particularly happened to the right wing over the last few years. I think that what you see in the difference is that I would say Hillbilly Elegy attempts to kind of diagnose its characters or use its characters to diagnose, you know, a kind of aspect of America that I think, you know, ultimately it was not successful in that. And Nomadland is about characters who are affected by different economic forces, but are ultimately not symbols of it. They are still kind of fully fleshed out individuals. And I think that that's the huge difference. But I think also, you know, obviously, and this is like a long time Oscar movie problem, Hillbilly Elegy is a bunch of kind of well-known actors, you know, transforming themselves to look like people living, you know, working class lives in Ohio. And in Nomadland, you have a bit of that with Frances McDormand, but you also have actual people living these lives.
Yeah. And is the fact that Hillbilly Elegy has received a more muted response than Nomadland a sign that viewers are maybe getting tired of some of Hollywood's poverty tropes?
I would like to believe so, you know, especially around this time of year. I think that there's a particular type of like awards hopeful, let's say, that can feel, I think, uncomfortably when it's done poorly, feel very uncomfortably like tourism, you know, in particular, like I think in the case of Hillbilly Elegy, it can feel like tourism in this particular type of like economic distress and portrayals of you know, abuse and addiction. And I think, you know, that tension is always been there when you have kind of movie stars who obviously don't come from directly from these lives playing them. I think you can have that tension. But I do think recently that there's been a bit of pushback on that, or at least a desire for greater authenticity.
And are there other recent movies that you think have done a good job at capturing the lives of characters living paycheck to paycheck?
You know, one that comes to mind for me is actually, I think just through coincidence, another film that used a lot of first-time performers, not necessarily all ones from the kind of world it depicted. But I thought The Florida Project, which is, you know, Sean Baker's film that was set at a kind of week-to-week motel outside of Disney World, where a lot of people who were just like unable to basically have the resources to get an apartment live in this kind of final spot for a lot of people before homelessness. And I think that it was very kind of frank about its depictions of just being in this kind of economically desperate situation, while at the same time, really, I think, like, lacking the potential for condescension that can sometimes come with, you know, a big Hollywood movie tackling themes like that. I think it really felt like it was immersed in the community that it sought to depict.
Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. Allison, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. We made it halfway through the week, and I'm really enjoying myself. I hope you guys are too. Thank you for tuning in. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet at Rebe Ibarra C. And we also can take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Back with you tomorrow.